mom hates us. This kind of language in the past leads to these questions of why isn't the president now directly using that megaphone to condemn it?
Well, then take the words and put them in one category and take the actions and put them in another.
Oh, he's the president, but we have to separate the words from the actions like we're taking out the recycling?
Word, action, word, word, but it's still got a lot of spaghetti in it, so action.
The president is not a white supremacist. I'm not sure how many times we have to say that.
Mr. Owl, how many times do we have to say President Trump is not a white supremacist?
Let's find out. One, a two, a three, four, five, six, 10,417, 10,480, 4,392,243,120. Oh, my.
And I'm sorry, but his only actions are words. Other than Twitter, what else does he do? You won't let us watch him golf, even though if you did, it would be higher rated than the Super Bowl. I mean, I would watch, because there's so much that I want to know. Is he actually good, or is he terrible and everyone pretends that he's good? I know he cheats, but how? Is he good at it, or is he super obvious? Does he make a weird noise when he swings? And if so, is it the same noise, or does it change based on the club? Seriously, televise his next golf game, sell it on pay-per-view, and build your wall with that money. I'm sorry, but you don't get to put Trump's words in a different category unless that category is signs you might be having a stroke.
Every single car out there, even the really expensive ones, controlled by large donors, 10,000 known or suspected gang members.
Mulvaney then went on to claim that despite Trump's long-established history of anti-Muslim bigotry, Trump himself was not Islamophobic.
I hear what folks say, oh, Donald Trump said this during the campaign. Look at what we've done while we've been here. I don't think anybody could say that the president is anti-Muslim.
Well, let me try. The president is anti-Muslim. Yep, that was not hard at all. It was easy to say. Certainly wasn't as hard as saying suspested. Trump has spent his entire political career trafficking in anti-Muslim bigotry, and now he's defending people who've done the same. Of course, these guys have to stick together because they are a
small group of people that have very, very serious problems.
The twilight hour of socialism has arrived in our hemisphere, and hopefully, by the way, it's also arrived, that twilight hour, in our great country, which is doing better than it's ever done economically.
But Trump is ready for a fight, and not just metaphorically. Here's what he said in a recent interview with the Breitbart.
You know, the left plays a tougher game. It's very funny. I actually think that the people on the right are tougher, but they don't play it tougher, okay? I can tell you, I have the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of the bikers for Trump. I have the tough people, but they don't play it tough until they go to a certain point. Then it would be very bad. Very bad.
Okay, no big deal. Just want to point out the president of the United States just threatened to terrorize his opponents with the police, a military junta, and roving biker gangs. It's all part of his new slogan, Make America Great Again, and if you don't, Spider Heel will whip you with a bike chain. At times like these, I think about the president we could have had, Hillary Clinton. Not perfect, obviously, but, you know, not publicly threatening the purge.
I saw a newspaper picture from the political campaign. A woman was kissing a child who was obviously in pain. She spills with compassion as that young child's face in her hands she grips. Can you imagine all that greed and avarice coming down on that child's lips? Well, I hope I don't die too soon. I pray the Lord. soul to say, yes, I'll be a good boy. I'm trying so hard to behave, because there's one thing I know, I'd like to live long enough to savor. That's when United States. It was the whore of the world.
Donald.
It was her matter. And the future looked as bright and as clear as the black tarmac at her. Well, I hope that she sleeps well at night, isn't haunted by every tiny detail. When she held that lovely face in her hands, all she thought of was betrayal. And now the cynical ones say that it all ends the same in the long run. Try telling that to the desperate father who just squeezed the life from his only son, and how it's only voices in your head and dreams you've never dreamt. Try telling him the subtle difference between justice and contempt. Try telling me she isn't angry with this pitiful discontent. When they flaunt it in your face as you line up for punishment, and then expect you to say thank you, straighten up, proud and pleased, because you've only got the symptoms, you haven't got the whole disease. Just like a schoolboy whose head's like a tin can, filled up with dreams, then parked down the drain. Try telling that to the boys on both sides, being blown to bits. I'll be going before we fold our arms and start to weep. I never thought for a moment that human life could be so cheap. But when it's
the song.
this week from
Bobby
Day,
Bob Dylan, Rem, Elvis Costello, Golden Earring,
thanks to
Sarah Sanders, Rudy Giuliani, Stephen Colbert,
Ling,
Rames,
Jimmy
Kimmel, Seth Meyers,
Chris
Jamzing,
George
Stephanopoulos, Stephanie Ruler, Andrea Mitchell, Howard Kurt Wajahat, Ali
Chris
Hayes, Margaret Brennan, Mick Mulvaney,
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
Hi, this is Chris France of Talking Heads, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC, Accra.
I just want to say RIP to all the victims of the New Zealand mosque shooting.
Yes.
The count is 51, unfortunately, victims to this shooting, and the youngest victim was 3 years old.
Wow.
Damn.
So, you know, prayers to their families. But good news is that less than 24 hours later, they banned semi-automatic rifles.
Yeah, we
all it took was one shooting, and that's all I'm going to say on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to give a shout-out to Hudson Muslim Youth.
Yes.
And also Catherine Belke from the First Presbyterian Church. You know, they got together and they put denominations to the side, and like I seen, like, you know, Jewish rabbi, the Muslim youth, Christians, Catholic, everything, everybody, all in one room, you know, really together as a community for protection of our Muslim population. So shout out to everybody that was involved in that.
Yeah. Big shout out. Can I give them a clap? Is that okay to give them a clap? Okay, I just didn't want to do something that, you know.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Elizabeth Cortell of Woodland Hills, California. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are back. Big Vern, Slate Diddy, Ray, a.k.a. the Grand Finale, and the one and only, like she said, save the best for last, J-Mac, our queen of the Drive Time Radio Show on WGXC 90.7 FM. I am here with a very special person, and it's our exalted ruler. Well, you know, in reality, she really was my exalted ruler.
That's right.
I don't want to rub it in.
It's gonna claim it for yourself.
Well, you know,
bye.
Yeah, or, like, you know how people be throwing up their signs, 787. Holla if you hear me. 787. But this is a pleasure for me to be here with her, and me and Christine have our friendship is beyond. We work together, but our friendship is so great, and Christine had experienced some things, and I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to. I want to let you hear her talk about it. But I went.
You just don't want to cry.
No. I'll tell you the truth, Ray. I just don't want to cry. But no, but seriously, I went to. They did a fundraiser, and the one thing about Christine, so like, you know the people that do the most for the community, they never want any help.
Yeah.
Like they don't. They like, no, I'm fine. But they made her do it. And,
yes, they did.
They made her do it, and the output was just it was crazy. It was just so many people and so much love. But when she got up there and spoke, I just wanted, because she's a friend of the show. She's a family member of our show, and I just prayed that she would share this information with you guys. So here's Christine, and if you got tissue, get your tissue. Now, Slay.
I'm gonna try not to, but
Slay,
if, can't promise nothing.
Don't fake.
I'm gonna go to the bathroom.
No, you're not.
I'll follow you.
Right to the bathroom. Let it out.
If I see Slay tap J Mac and ask her to move, so he can get by, I know why.
It ain't happening.
I'm gonna go right under the table.
Okay, Christine, all yours.
All right, thank you for making it all mine. And I'll try my best to also not need a tissue. So, as I go through this, on November 27th, my life changed forever. I remember it was a stressful day, and I was home relaxing. The doorbell rang, and outside was a state trooper, not for me, that was checking on our neighborhood because someone saw an unusual car in our development.
I came to visit.
Okay. We were ending the conversation, and all of a sudden, it felt like someone was squeezing my left eyeball. I hurried the trooper out the door because I didn't know what was happening. Seconds later, I started with cold sweats. My head got a muffled feeling, and as they say, got the worst headache of my life. Within 15 minutes, I was vomiting and continued vomiting until 4 a.m. on Wednesday. At one point, I posted on Facebook asking if anyone had the symptoms of a flu with vomiting and a horrible headache. A few people responded and said, yes, there's a flu going around, and finished up with, hope you feel better soon. I was up all night praying that this wouldn't last long because I had too many things going on. Eventually that night, I did the one thing that everyone says not to do. I Googled my symptoms. And the first thing that came up was symptoms of an aneurysm. Of course, like most people, I said, no way. It can't be. And I just struggled the remainder of the night with the headache and vomiting. Wednesday morning, I woke up not feeling any better, so I called into work and said to my manager, I wouldn't be in. I didn't know what was wrong, but maybe the flu, but I stated that I thought I had an aneurysm with a smiley face and an LOL, and at the end said, I'll let you know how I feel and if I feel better later. All morning I tried to convince myself that it would go away, and I made every excuse in the book not to go to the doctor or urgent care. By noontime I couldn't take the headache any longer, and off to urgent care I went. In a short version, they sent me home with a migraine and the beginning stages of acute glaucoma. They told me with the headache, if the headache didn't get any better, to go to the ER tomorrow. So home I went, took some Tylenol, and went to bed. Did Vern leave on purpose? Thursday morning, I got up and didn't feel any better, but I knew I had to go to work. I missed one day already, and I had to get into the office to get stuff done. I lasted about till 11:30. My manager and coworker said, please go home. You look terrible. I sat there at my desk in agony and hemmed and hawed on what to do, because at this point I was getting scared that the pain was not getting any better, and again making excuses why I didn't have the time or money to go to the ER. Finally, I gave in and said I can't stand the pain anymore. And I called my husband and said, we need to go to Albany Emergency Room ASAP. Finally, we were on our way to St. Peter's. I got there, got checked in, explained my symptoms, and off to the CAT scan I went. I wasn't there no more than 10 minutes. The doctor came in on call and says, you have a blockage in the brain, and you are in the wrong hospital, and we need to transport you to Albany Med. Well, as you can imagine, that news was a shock, and I asked him to please get my husband, who was in the waiting room, and a very good friend waiting there also, to tell them what was going on. At that point, not really knowing the severity, I said to them, please go back to Hudson. You need to get back to work. By the time they transport me to the with the ambulance and run more tests on me, it will be late and there's nothing you can do but sit in the waiting room. I'll call you when with what I find out, and we will go from there. They both looked at me like, no, we're not leaving. But eventually, for some reason, for the first time ever, they listened to me, and off they went. Finally, 45 minutes later, I was in Albany Medical Center, in their ER room. And within half an hour, a neurosurgeon was standing in front of me telling me that I have a brain aneurysm that had ruptured. I proceeded to tell them, and they proceeded to tell me that I needed to have surgery within the hour. So, of course, I came back with, that's not going to work. How about we do it tomorrow? I just sent my husband home, and he is 45 minutes away. He will never make it back. She said, absolutely not. We are doing surgery tonight because you will not live to see tomorrow if we don't. Sheesh. So when I thought I had the worst news to tell my husband when I was at St. Peter's, I now had to call him to tell him more devastating news. The neurosurgeon couldn't have been more heartful and understanding as I laid there in tears trying to figure this all out. I finally asked if she could call my husband because I couldn't. As the phone ringing, I said to her, please be gentle, he is a sensitive guy, and off she went with my phone. She came back and I quickly talked to him and he said he was on his way. I then made some other phone calls to close friends and to let them know what was going on and hung up crying and saying, I'll talk to you when I get out of surgery. Shortly after, I was headed to the operating room with the ER nurse as my witness to sign my medical release forms because there was no one else there. She left and a team of many people prepared me for surgery. I laid there not able to say goodbye to anyone but her, and not knowing if I was going to survive the surgery to see my loved ones. I tried.
I tried to tell you.
Loved ones in a few hours. What seemed like a lifetime, I finally woke up freezing in the recovery room and eventually was sent to the ICU. I have no idea what time it was or how long this all took. They got me settled and asked if I wanted to see my family. I remember saying, they are still here waiting for me? And she said, of course they are. To my surprise, I had my closest beings waiting for me to wake up. I couldn't have been more happy to see them all. We chatted and laughed for a bit. I was concerned that I needed to get out of the hospital because we had Winter Walk on Saturday and the Elks was having a food booth there that I was helping to organize. They all entertained me and said not to worry, it was under control. Eventually, we got in trouble for being too loud because there was a Gestapo of the ICU for a nurse. She kindly said, you all need to leave and you knew not to mess with her. So we all said our goodbyes. I had no idea how long I would be in ICU, but I figured a few days and I would be going home. No one said anything to me. By Sunday, I finally asked the doctor what was going on and why I wasn't going home. She kind of giggled and said, I guess I picked the short straw to tell you that you will be here for 21 to 25 days. Again in shock, apparently out of the five people that were there on Thursday, got the same news, but not one of them wanted to tell me that what was going on. And I'm not quite sure why not. As the days passed and I laid there wondering why I was so blessed to be able to be talking, eating, and walking on my own, I watched several people come in with their heads shaved, tubes coming out of their brains, and most of them having to have one-on-one nursing every minute. I came out of this surgery with a bloodshot left eye, some difficulty with hand-to-mouth coordination, and short-term memory loss, which most of you know that I didn't need help losing. What more blessings could I have asked for? I fought every day to get better, going to physical therapy, getting woke up every 2 hours just as I was able to fall asleep, to take my meds, and get shots in my stomach to prevent seizures from happening. I had the best decorated room in ICU, which brightened my day. I was determined to beat the 21 to 25 day stay in ICU, and at day 14, I was moved to a regular private room. And on day 15, I was on my way home. My recovery doesn't end there, as I am learning every day this is a slow and long process. I am a lucky lady to be able to be sitting here, as I am almost with no side effects from a rupturing of an aneurysm. The process doesn't end here. I have two more procedures to go through. In May, I will be undergoing an angiogram, which is a procedure that takes movies of the brain and the aneurysm to see if it has grown or if the coils that were placed were staying secure. There is a possibility that I could still have a stroke or have major side effects from this procedure. This will tell the surgeons when they are going to be able to do the second procedure, which is the permanent placement of a stent. That procedure will probably be done 6 months after the first one. Once I'm recovered from having the stent put in, I should be good to go as new, keeping my fingers crossed in about a year. Some statistics that I want to give you is that there is a ruptured brain aneurysm every 18 minutes. 40% of them are fatal. Those of us that survive, 66% of us suffer from permanent neurological damage. And approximately 15% of patients die before reaching the hospital. So I consider myself a lucky girl, and I had angels looking over me every minute. With all that being said, one of my goals is to be an advocate for brain aneurysm awareness. The color burgundy and is the color of the awareness. The month of September is the Brain Aneurysm Awareness Month. So I hope to be able to promote that when that time comes. So with all that said, it's time for me to say thank you to all of my supporters. I have no idea, including you guys here in the station, how I could have done it without you. I know there... there's just a couple of phrases that I want to be able to say. Mm-hmm. Lastly, I read something, and I thought it was fitting. In a blink of an eye, everything can change. So forgive often and love with all your heart. You may never know when you may not have that chance again. And always remember, live today to its fullest, because tomorrow was never promised.
Oh my. Now, I got it now.
That was humbling.
Humbling.
Yeah. Oh man.
That was very humbling.
Let's go around the room, man. We're going to talk about this. We do this real radio right here. Wow. Ray?
Yeah. I held it together, first of all.
Good job.
We thought you walked out the gold tier a little bit. No. No, but it's just powerful, and to hear the statistics of how fatal and how, you know, how this something that none of us really think about. I mean, we go on about our days every day, and certain ailments and certain instances medically that, you know, that can happen to anyone at any given moment are usually not something we talk about, or we don't even consider it. We just kind of get up. It's the, you know, business as usual, same routine. And like, I think Slade mentioned it a minute ago, it's humbling because all of those things health-wise we take for granted, and here we are with a survivor sitting in the room with us. Yeah. You know what I mean? So...
Most deaf. J-Mac?
I just want to commend you for all of everything that you went through. I mean, I can't imagine the strength it takes, but...
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm glad everything, you know, you made it through.
The Honorable Slade Diddy.
It's crazy because when Vern first told us this, like we don't hear the backstory and everything, so we hear this and we like, ah, oh, man, but we like, you know, it's Christine, she gonna make it, like she's good, like you don't, we don't know the transition of everything, and like that whole story took me through probably every emotion possible. Yeah. You know, like it was like a lot of fear, and then it was like some happiness, and then it was like, that's so her, you know, she wants the, they gave her 21 days and she like, I'm gonna beat this, and you're like, of course, and then also like, you guys really love your job. Like, you guys love, like, no, I gotta go back to work, I gotta do this, I gotta make sure all of this stuff, and I'm just thinking, wow, like, how can you be that strong? Like, I get a earache and I'm like, I don't know if I can come back. I can't make it. Y'all gotta go on without me. Like,
here's the song Shortwave from Hilo Tenga's 2018 release, There's a Riot Going On.
Elsa Levasseur, and I'm a sustaining member, and I give monthly on the internet. It's so easy to listen to WGXC Accra.
The CARE Historical Society was established in 2009. Our mission is to collect, study, interpret, and preserve the history of the town of CARE, New York, for the educational and cultural enrichment of present and future generations. We love to bring history alive through our programming, such as our Hometown Heroes banner program, our State of the Union dinners, our Victorian teas. Each teach history while having fun. Members receive absolutely free our quarterly journal, the CARE Herald, which is jam-packed with historical articles, pictures, and society news. Everyone, however, can access the CARE Historical Society's Facebook page, which is a treasure trove of CARE history and memories. It's easy to become part of our historical family. Call Sylvia at 518-821-3852 or email the CARE Historical Society at carohistsociety@yahoo.com.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable. mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Melissa Alfdermar and Tony Stone of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. Thank you.
Nick Vanderkoek, the producer of the podcast Love and Radio, visited the Uptown Summer Youth Employees at the Sanctuary for Independent Media and discussed podcasting techniques as the youth prepare to create audio stories of their own.
It's worked out for me pretty well, but like I kind of did everything opposite. Like how you should.
I kind of grew up listening to a lot of sort of public radio.
One thing that they teach you in that kind of genre is that radio is a didactic medium. It's not enough to sort of present a story. You have to sort of like explain what it means, and you have to sort of explain everything. And that's a totally legit way of going about things. Like there's a lot of stuff that I love that operates that way, but I personally always found that quite limited. And so even though the show has like evolved a lot over the last 13 years, it's always had that DNA in it of like I didn't want to tell people like what they were supposed to feel and what they were supposed to think. And so that's why there's very little of me in it, while you're just hearing this voice and people kind of have to piece it together kind of on their own, which I think can make for like a more powerful storytelling experience, for lack of a better term.
Do you think that radio has become less critical of itself? Radio or podcasts, they've become more narrative or linear kind of storytelling. So do you think that it's, I mean, obviously it's changing.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm pretty mixed on it. I mean, I think in some ways, when I was starting out, there was like so little competition out there. And you would think with more shows, there's going to be like more diversity of approaches. But I think also, because there's money in there now, people want to do the thing that is definitely going to succeed. And they do end up sounding pretty similar. There are a lot of, especially in podcasting, there are a lot of shows that are just much easier to produce, that are like kind of chat-based, and it's like people sitting in a room. And those require some work and thought to make still good, but it's much easier to get like advertisers for that. It's much easier to pitch that to like a network. I tend to record for hours and hours and hours and hours, and then that gets edited down. So I'd say each episode typically takes about a month of work. Typically, and this is just sort of how, this wasn't necessarily intentional, but you tend to hear a lot more questions as the story goes on, because it's also just like, there's a certain style in sort of radio documentary, for lack of a better term, where you completely cut out the interviewer, and it's just sort of this monologue, and I personally like to be reminded that there is someone else in the room that's asking questions, so that you have to have like a little bit of skepticism, I think. So I don't prep people other than to sort of describe the process and describe the show and say, you know, this is all pre-recorded, so like if you want to back up and go again, that's totally cool. And then we just kind of wing it. And then you just have to sort of respect their space and kind of let them sort of take the lead on sort of what they're comfortable with. To do face-to-face interviews all that much these days, but it's also it's like relatively easy too. Like now you can kind of interview people from wherever, and there's lots of great tools where they can kind of mic themselves as well. Like now we have advertisers, we have some resources, so we can usually get like an engineer to go and record the person in person, so I'll interview them over the phone, or producer mine will interview them over the phone, and someone else will be in the room with them recording them, and then we combine the tape together so it basically sounds like they're in the same room. That's called a tape sync. In general, I do two-hour interviews. The first one tends to have very little structure to it, where I'm really just kind of like just following my own curiosity about the person and just having a discussion around it. The second interview, at that point, I have a better understanding of like what the shape of the story ought to be.
so the second interview tends to be much more directed, just sort of like kind of the skeleton of the story. And then based on those two things, then we begin the process of editing, and in the process of editing, we tend to notice, well, there's this, like, actually, this is this question that, like, I actually hadn't really considered now that I'm, like, listening to him tell the story again. So let's go back and we'll ask him that. Or he didn't tell this thing. He told this one story in a slightly confusing way. Maybe we can have him retell that piece. So then we do a third follow-up interview. And that one tends to be a bit shorter because we know sort of like, okay, we want to get this, and this. And then hopefully, like, we have everything we need from that.
So one thing I heard that is very cool, is that you, as a radio artist and a storyteller, are using some other audio tracks to emotionally carry the story on. Could you talk about that a little?
We use music. There's a lot of kind of subtle stuff going on. We actually, like, we run the voice through filters, so we're just sort of creating that space. We're just, like, very focused on the audio and also just sort of how the audio interacts. If it is a piece that has, like, kind of rich audio elements, to begin with, I will be collecting the sounds in the moment. In terms of finding the subjects, it's, well, as the show has become more popular, we have relied more and more on kind of outside pitches, so, like, listeners will write in with ideas for stories, or radio freelancers who will pitch stuff to us. But before that, it really was kind of all over the shop. I mean, sometimes it was just, like, stories that, like, a friend would tell me, you know, oh, my neighbor, you know, down the block, like, he's a survivalist or whatever. I didn't actually do that story. I don't know. But someone was telling me about that the other day. Sometimes it's because we have this, like, slightly strange format, it's also very, very helpful for doing stuff that has been in the news to some degree. So for instance, I did a story about a guy who was in his 20s and his wife died of cancer. And before she had died, she had written out sort of like her life goals, and he had committed his life to finishing out her life goals. So, and a lot of it was like quite ambitious. It was like, get a PhD, run a half marathon, take a train across Canada, and I had seen, he had been on a couple, like, TV shows, but just, like, these very quick little four-minute segments where it was like, oh, here's this guy doing this crazy thing, you know, tell us a couple of things about it, okay, cool, bye. And I knew there was, like more of a long-form story there. Things about it. Okay, cool, bye. And I knew there was like more of a long-form story there. And I think he was like quite grateful to actually like take the time. Most of the people that I talk to are really happy with how things turn out, because I really give them the space and the time to talk things through in a way that you don't get in media generally. I'm sure we've all seen at some point some sort of like very combative interview between like a host and a guest. Maybe the guest is doing something wrong or whatever, but like then they serve no purpose other than to show that the host is like somehow morally superior, and I'm not interested in that. You know, if there is someone who's sort of like morally dodgy who I have on the show, I don't have them on the show so I can harangue them. I still want to understand that. Be out in the world and just like meeting random weirdos.
And open to serendipity.
And open to serendipity, yeah. I mean, especially in this day and age, like, everything is, like, on the internet. And so it's very easy to have these, like, curated experiences in your lives. And sometimes it's nice to just, like, throw out the phone and just go for a walk and, like, see what the hell you happen upon, you know? The stories that I go after tend to be the ones where I don't know how I feel about them myself, you know? I don't go in with an agenda. And that often makes the best pieces, when it's like, when your mind changes over the course of working on it, that's the sign that you're on something really good.
That was Nick Vanderkoek, producer of the podcast Love and Radio.
I'm Tom Rowe, and you're listening to the radio.
You take the ability to talk for granted, don't you? And why shouldn't you? You talk every day of your life and you don't think much about it. But did you realize that millions of people suffer from voice problems? These millions can't take talking for granted. For them, to talk is a struggle.
Do you have a voice like...
No.
Do you have a voice like...
No.
Do you have a voice like...
Yeah.
Mine? Do you have a voice like...
No.
As it is,
no.
Do you have a voice like...
Is he?
Do you have a voice like... Mine? Do you have a voice like... Do you want a voice like mine? Do you want a voice like... Mine? Do you want a voice like...
Is he?
Do you want... Do you want a voice like... With a voice like mine? What would you want a voice like? Do you want a voice? Do you want a voice like... What would you do with a voice like... What would you do? How would you survive? Would you seize me? Would you hide? Would you seize power? Would you dissect it? Ingest it? Roll it around on your tongue? And then what? And then what? And then what? Would it give you pleasure? Would it get you in? Would it take you away? Gently? With a light touch? Take it out. Take it away. Take it. How can you... Take it out. Take it away. Take it. Gently? With a light... Roll it around on your pleasure. And then what? 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 And then what?
Successful sound of wonderful